body and soul. Chase called the night of January 18th a despairing era in our sufferings. 2 months of deprivation and fear had reached an unbearable climax as they anticipated the horrors to come. Our minds were wrought up to the highest pitch of dread and apprehension for our fate, Chase wrote, and all in them was dark, gloomy, and confused. At around 8 o'clock, the darkness came to life with a familiar sound, the breathing of sperm whales. It was a black night, and the noise that had once signaled the thrill of the hunt now terrified them. We could distinctly hear the furious thrashing of their tails in the water, Chase remembered, and our weak minds pictured out their appalling and hideous aspects. As the whales surfaced and dove around them, Richard Peterson took an immediate fright and pleaded with his companions to row them to safety. But no one had the strength even to lift an oar. After 3 whales passed the stern in rapid succession, blowing and spouting at a terrible rate, the pod disappeared. When Peterson's panic had receded, he talked with Chase about his religious beliefs. Although he knew his own death was imminent, Peterson's faith in God remained undiminished. He reasoned very sensibly, Chase wrote, and with much composure. Peterson had a wife back in New York City, and he asked Chase to contact her if the first mate should ever reach home alive. The next day, January 19th, the wind blew so fiercely that they had to take in their sails and lie to. Lightning flashed and the rain poured down as the wind shifted through every point of the compass. As their little craft tossed in the confused seas, Peterson lay between the seats of the boat, utterly dispirited and broken down. That evening, the wind finally settled into the east-northeast. On January 20th, exactly 2 months since the sinking of the Essex, Richard Peterson declared that it was his time to die. When Chase offered Peterson his daily ration of bread, he refused it, saying, "It may be of service to someone, but can be of none to me." Soon after, he lost the power of speech. Modern-day proponents of euthanasia have long endorsed the combined effects of starvation and dehydration as a painless and dignified way for a terminally ill patient to die. In the final stages, hunger pangs cease, as does the sensation of thirst. The patient slips into unconsciousness as the deterioration of his internal organs results in a peaceful death. This was apparently how Richard Peterson passed away. "The breath appeared to be leaving his body without the least pain," Chase reported, and at 4 o'clock, he was gone. The next day, at latitude 35 degrees 7 minutes south, longitude 105 degrees 46 minutes west, 1,000 miles from Juan Fernandez, Peterson's body joined Joy's in the vast burial ground of the sea. Chapter 11. Games of Chance. On January 20th, 1821, 8 days after losing sight of Chase's boat, Pollard's and Hendricks' men were coming to the end of their provisions. That day, Lawson Thomas, one of the blacks on Hendricks' boat, died. With barely a pound of hardtack left to share among 10 men, Hendricks and his crew dared speak of a subject that had been on all their minds: whether they should eat instead of bury the body. For as long as men had been sailing the world's oceans, famished sailors had been sustaining themselves on the remains of dead shipmates. By the early 19th century, cannibalism at sea was so widespread that survivors often felt compelled to inform their rescuers if they had not resorted to it, since, according to one historian, suspicion of this practice among starving castaways was a routine reaction. One of the most thoroughly documented cases of cannibalism occurred in the winter of 1710, when the Nottingham Galley, a British trading vessel under the command of Captain John Dean, wrecked on Boone Island, a tiny outcropping of rock just off the coast of Maine. Despite being within sight of the mainland, the men found themselves marooned with no provisions and no way of reaching help. When the ship's carpenter died in the 3rd week, one of the crew suggested that they use their shipmate's body for food. Captain Dean initially found the proposal to be most grievous and shocking. Then, as they stood over the carpenter's dead body, a discussion ensued. After abundance of mature thought and consultation about the lawfulness or sinfulness on the one hand, and the absolute necessity on the other, Dean wrote, judgment, conscience, etc. were obliged to submit to the more prevailing arguments of our craving appetites. 111 years later, in the middle of the Pacific, 10 men of the Essex reached a similar conclusion. 2 months after deciding to spurn the Society Islands because, in Pollard's words, we feared we should be devoured by cannibals, they were about to eat one of their own shipmates. First, they had to butcher the body. On Nantucket, there was a slaughterhouse at the foot of Old North Wharf where any island boy could watch a cow or sheep be transformed into marketable cuts of meat. On a whale ship, it was the black members of the crew who prepared and cooked the food. In the case of the Essex, more than 30 hogs and dozens of tortoises had been butchered by the African-American cook before the whale attack. And, of course, all 20 crew members had taken part in the cutting up of several dozen sperm whales. But this was not a whale, or a hog, or a tortoise. This was Lawson Thomas, a shipmate with whom they had shared 2 hellish months in an open boat. Whoever butchered Thomas's body had to contend not only with the cramped quarters of a 25-foot boat, but also with the chaos of his own emotions. The crew of the Nottingham galley, the ship that wrecked off Maine, had found it so difficult to begin the gruesome task of cutting up the carpenter's body that they pleaded with the reluctant Captain Dean to do it for them. Their incessant prayers and entreaties at last prevailed, Dean wrote, and by night I had performed my labor. Dean, like most sailors forced to resort to cannibalism, began by removing the most obvious signs of the corpse's humanity, the head, hands, feet, and skin, and consigned them to the sea. If Hendricks and his men followed Dean's example, they next would have removed Thomas's heart, liver, and kidneys from the bloody casket of his ribs. Then they would have begun to hack the meat from the backbone, ribs, and pelvis. In any case, Pollard reported that after lighting a fire on the flat stone at the bottom of the boat, they roasted the organs and meat and began to eat. Instead of easing their hunger pangs, their first taste of meat only intensified their atavistic urge to eat. The saliva flowed in their mouths as their long-dormant stomachs gurgled with digestive juices, and the more they ate, the hungrier they became. Anthropologists and archaeologists studying the phenomenon of cannibalism have estimated that the average human adult would provide about 66 pounds of edible meat. But Lawson Thomas's body was not average. Autopsies of starvation victims have revealed a dramatic atrophy of muscle tissue and a complete absence of fat, replaced in some instances by a translucent gelatinous substance. Starvation and dehydration had also shrunk Thomas's internal organs, including the heart and liver. His body may have yielded as little as 30 pounds of lean, fibrous meat. On the following day, when the captain's store of bread ran out, Pollard and his men were glad to partake of the wretched fare with the other crew. 2 days later, on January 23rd, the 63rd day since leaving the wreck, yet another member of Hendrick's crew died and was eaten. And like Lawson Thomas before him, Charles Shorter was black. It was likely that the African Americans had suffered from an inferior diet prior to the sinking, but there may have been yet another factor at work. A recent scientific study comparing the percentage of body fat among different ethnic groups claims that American blacks tend to have less body fat than their Caucasian counterparts. Once a starving body exhausts its reserves of fat, it begins consuming muscle, a process that soon results in the deterioration of the internal organs and eventually death. The blacks' initially lower amount of body fat meant that they had begun living off muscle tissue before the whites. The importance of body fat in determining long-term survival under starvation conditions was shown among the members of the Donner Party, a group of settlers who became snowbound in the foothills of the Sierras during the winter of 1847. Despite their reputation as the weaker sex, the women tended to outlast the men, thanks in part to their higher percentage of body fat, approximately 10% more than males. Now that people had begun to die among the Essex crew, it was no accident that the first to go, with the exception of the sickly Matthew Joy, who in Chase's words did not die of absolute starvation were African American. Of the whites, the Essex's 29-year-old captain had an advantage. He was short, had a tendency toward corpulence prior to the ordeal, and being older had a lower metabolic rate. Of these 20 sailors, Pollard was the most likely to survive this ordeal of starvation. Yet given the complex range of factors, psychological as well as physiological, influencing each man's health, it was impossible to predict with total precision who would live and who would die. More than 100 miles to the south, as their shipmates consumed their second body in 4 days, Owen Chase and his men drifted in a windless sea. A week of eating only 1.5 ounces of bread a day had left them hardly able to crawl around the boat and possessing but strength enough to convey our scanty morsel to our mouths. Boils had begun to break out on their skin. On the morning of January 24th, with another day of calms and broiling sun ahead of them, Chase was certain that some of his crew would not see nightfall. "What it was that buoyed me above all the terrors which surrounded us," Chase wrote, "God alone knows." That night, the first mate had a vivid dream. He had just sat down to a splendid and rich repast, where there was everything that the most dainty appetite could desire. But just as he reached for his first taste of food, he awoke to the cold realities of my miserable situation. Fired to a kind of madness by his dream, Chase began to gnaw on the leather sheathing of an oar, only to find that he lacked the strength in his jaws to penetrate the stiff, salt-caked hide. With the death of Peterson, Chase's crew had been whittled down to only 3, Nantucketers Benjamin Lawrence and Thomas Nickerson, along with Isaac Cole from Rochester, Massachusetts. As their sufferings mounted, the men relied increasingly on the first mate. Chase reported that they pressed me continually with questions upon the probability of our reaching land again. I kept constantly rallying my spirits to enable me to afford them comfort. Chase had changed since the beginning of the ordeal. Instead of the harsh disciplinarian who had doled out rations with a gun by his side, he now spoke to the men in what Nickerson described as an almost cheerful voice. As their torments reached new heights, Chase recognized that it wasn't discipline his men needed, but encouragement. For as they had all seen with Peterson, hope was all that stood between them and death. Chase's ability to adjust his manner of leadership to the needs of his men begs comparison to one of the greatest and most revered leaders of all time, Sir Ernest Shackleton. Shackleton's feat of delivering all 27 men of his Antarctic expedition to safety has been called the supreme epic of leadership in totally impossible circumstances. In 1916, after 17 months of fighting the cruelest conditions imaginable, which included a grueling trek across the pack ice, 2 voyages in tiny whaleboat-sized craft over a storm-tossed southern ocean, and a terrifying hike across the jagged peaks of South Georgia, Shackleton finally reached a whaling station and safety, then returned to rescue those he had left behind on Elephant Island. Shackleton's sensitivity to the needs of his men was legendary. So great was his care of his people, his associate Frank Worsley wrote, that to rough men it seemed at times to have a touch of the woman about it, even to the verge of fussiness. But Shackleton was also capable of insisting on a Bligh-like discipline. On an earlier expedition, when one of the men felt his freedoms were being infringed upon, Shackleton quelled the insurrection by knocking the man to the ground. This combination of decisive, authoritative action and an ability to empathize with others is rarely found in a single leader. But Chase, at 23, almost half Shackleton's age, had learned to move beyond the ruthless intensity of a fishy man and do everything in his power to lift his men from the depths of despair. Nickerson called the first mate a remarkable man and recognized Chase's genius for identifying hope in a seemingly hopeless situation. Having already endured so much, Chase reasoned, they owed it to one another to cling as tenaciously to life as possible. I reasoned with them and told them that we would not die sooner by keeping our hopes. But it was more than a question of loyalty to one another. As far as Chase was concerned, God was also involved in this struggle for survival. The dreadful sacrifices and privations we had endured were to preserve us from death, he assured them, and were not to be put in competition with the price which we set upon our lives. In addition to saying it would be unmanly to repine at what neither admitted of alleviation nor cure, Chase insisted that it was our solemn duty to recognize in our calamities an overruling divinity, by whose mercy we might be suddenly snatched from peril, and to rely upon him alone, who tempers the wind to the shorn lamb. Although they had seen little evidence of the Lord's mercy in the last 2 months, Chase insisted that they bear up against all evils, and not weakly distrust the providence of the Almighty by giving ourselves up to despair. For the next 3 days the wind continued out of the east, forcing them farther and farther south. It was impossible to silence the rebellious repinings of our nature, Chase admitted. It was our cruel lot not to have had one bright anticipation realized, not one wish of our thirsting souls gratified. On January 26th, the 66th day since leaving the wreck, their noon observation indicated that they had sunk to latitude 36 degrees south, more than 600 nautical miles south of Henderson Island and 1,800 miles due west of Valparaiso, Chile. That day, the searing sun gave way to a bitterly cold rain. Starvation had lowered their body temperatures by several degrees, and with few clothes to warm their thin bodies, they were now in danger of dying of hypothermia. They had no choice but to try to head north, back toward the equator. With the breeze out of the east, they were forced to tack, turning with the steering oar until the wind came from the starboard side of the boat. Prior to reaching Henderson, it had been a maneuver they had accomplished with ease. Now, even though the wind was quite light, they no longer had the strength to handle the steering oar or trim the sails. After much labor, we got our boat about, Chase remembered, and so great was the fatigue attending this small exertion of our bodies that we all gave up for a moment and abandoned her to her own course. With no one steering or adjusting the sails, the boat drifted aimlessly. The men lay helpless and shivering in the bilge as, Chase wrote, the horrors of our situation came upon us with a despairing force and effect. After 2 hours, they finally marshaled enough strength to adjust the sails so that the boat was once again moving forward. But now they were sailing north, parallel to, but not toward, the coast of South America. Like Job before him, Chase could not help but ask, what narrow hopes still bound us to life? As Chase's men lay immobilized by hunger in the bottom of their boat, yet another member of Hendrick's crew died. This time it was Isaiah Shepherd, who became the third African-American to die and be eaten in only 7 days. The next day, January 28th, the 68th day since leaving the wreck, Samuel Reed, the sole black member of Pollard's crew, died and was eaten. That left William Bond in Hendrick's boat as the last surviving black in the Essex's crew. There was little doubt who had become the tropic birds and who had become the hawks. Sailors commonly accepted that eating human flesh brought a person's moral character down to the level of those brutish savages who voluntarily indulged in cannibalism. On Boone Island in 1710, Captain Dean had noticed a shocking transformation among his crew once they began to eat the carpenter's body. I found, in a few days, their natural dispositions changed, Dean wrote, and that affectionate, peaceable temper they had all along hitherto discovered totally lost, their eyes staring and looking wild, their countenances fierce and barbarous. But it wasn't the act of cannibalism that lowered a survivor's sense of civility. Rather, it was his implacable hunger. During the first leg of their voyage, Chase had noticed that their sufferings had made it difficult for them to maintain so magnanimous and devoted a character to our feelings. Even under the controlled circumstances of the 1945 Minnesota starvation experiment, the participants were aware of a distressing change in their behavior. A majority of the volunteers were members of the Church of the Brethren, and many had hoped that the period of deprivation would enhance their spiritual lives. But they found just the opposite to be true. Most of them felt that the semi-starvation had coarsened rather than refined them, it was reported, and they marveled at how thin their moral and social veneers seemed to be. In a another notorious case of survival cannibalism, sailors aboard the badly damaged Peggy were reaching the final stages of starvation on the stormy Atlantic in 1765. Although they still had more than enough left of the vessel's cargo of wine and brandy, it had been 18 days since they'd eaten the last of their food. Emboldened by alcohol, the first mate informed the captain that he and the rest of the crew were going to kill and eat a black slave. The captain refused to take part and, too weak to oppose them, overheard the terrifying sounds of the execution and subsequent feast from the cabin. A few days later, the crew appeared at the captain's door looking for another man to kill. "I told them that the poor Negro's death had done them no service," Captain Harrison wrote, "as they were as greedy and as emaciated as ever. The answer which they gave to this was that they were now hungry and must have something to eat." Like the crew of the Peggy, the Essex survivors were no longer operating under the rules of conduct that had governed their lives prior to the ordeal. They were members of what psychologists studying the effects of the Nazi concentration camps have called a modern feral community, a group of people reduced to an animal state very closely approaching raw motivation. Just as concentration camp inmates underwent, in the words of one psychologist, starvation in a state of extreme stress, so did the men of the Essex live from day to day, not knowing which one of them would be the next to die. Under these circumstances, survivors typically undergo a process of psychic deadening that one Auschwitz survivor described as a tendency to kill my feelings. Another woman expressed it as an amoral, even immoral, will to live. Nothing else counted but that I wanted to live. I would have stolen from husband, child, parent, or friend in order to accomplish this. Therefore, every day I disciplined myself with a sort of low, savage cunning to bend every effort, to devote every fiber of my being to do those things which would make that possible. Within a feral community, it is not uncommon for subgroups to develop as a collective form of defense against the remorseless march of horror. And it was here that the Nantucketers, their ties of kinship and religion stitching them together, had an overwhelming advantage. Since there would be no black survivors to contradict the testimonies of the whites, the possibility exists that the Nantucketers took a far more active role in ensuring their own survival than has been otherwise suggested. Certainly, the statistics raise suspicion. Of the first four sailors to be eaten, all were black. Short of murdering the black crew members, the Nantucketers could have refused to share meat with them. However, except for the fact that the majority of the blacks were assigned to a whaleboat commanded by a sickly mate, there is no evidence of overt favoritism in the boats. Indeed, what appears to have distinguished the men of the Essex was the great discipline and human compunction they maintained throughout the whole ordeal. If necessity forced them to act like animals, they did so with the deepest regrets. There was a reason why William Bond, in Hendrick's boat, was the last African-American left alive. Thanks to his position as steward in the officers' quarters, Bond had enjoyed a far more balanced and plentiful diet than his shipmates in the forecastle. But now that he was the only black among six whites, Bond had to wonder what the future held. Given the cruel mathematics of survival cannibalism, each death not only provided the remaining men with food, but reduced by one the number of people they had to share it with. By the time Samuel Reed died on January 28th, the seven survivors each received close to 3,000 calories worth of meat, up by almost a third since the death of Lawson Thomas. Unfortunately, even though this portion may have been roughly equivalent to each man's share of a Galapagos tortoise, it lacked the fat that the human body requires to digest meat. No matter how much meat they now had available to them, it was of limited nutritional value without a source of fat. The following night, January 29th, was darker than most. The two boat crews were finding it difficult to keep track of each other. They also lacked the strength to manage the steering oars and sails. That night, Pollard and his men looked up to find that the whaleboat containing Obed Hendricks, William Bond, and Joseph West had disappeared. Pollard's men were too weak to attempt to find the missing boat, either by raising a lantern or firing a pistol. That left George Pollard, Owen Coffin, Charles Ramsdell, and Barzillai Ray, all Nantucketers, alone for the first time since the sinking of the Essex. They were at latitude 35 degrees south, longitude 100 degrees west, 1,500 miles from the coast of South America, with only the half-eaten corpse of Samuel Reed to keep them alive. But no matter how grim their prospects might seem, they were better than those of Hendrick's boat crew. Without a compass or a quadrant, Hendricks and his men were now lost in an empty and limitless sea. On February 6th, the four men on Pollard's boat, having consumed the last morsel of Samuel Reed, began to look at each other with horrid thoughts in our minds, according to one survivor, but we held our tongues. Then the youngest of them, 16-year-old Charles Ramsdell, uttered the unspeakable. "They should cast lots," he said, "to see who would be killed so that the rest could live." The drawing of lots in a survival situation had long been an accepted custom of the sea. The earliest recorded instance dates back to the first half of the 17th century, when seven Englishmen sailing from the Caribbean island of St. Kitts were driven out to sea in a storm. After 17 days, one of the crew suggested that they cast lots. As it turned out, the lot fell to the man who had originally made the proposal, and after lots were cast again to see who should execute him, he was killed and eaten. In 1765, several days after the crew of the disabled Peggy had eaten the remains of the black slave, lots were drawn to see who would be the next to serve as food. The lot fell to David Flatt, a foremastman and one of the most popular sailors in the crew. "The shock of the decision was great," wrote Captain Harrison, "and the preparations for execution dreadful." Flatt requested that he be given some time to prepare himself for death, and the crew agreed to postpone the execution until 11 the next morning. The dread of his death sentence proved too much for Flatt. By midnight he had become deaf. By morning he was delirious. Incredibly, a rescue ship was sighted at 8 o'clock. But for David Flatt, it was too late. Even after the Peggy's crew had been delivered to England, Harrison reported that the unhappy Flatt still continued out of his senses. Drawing lots was not a practice to which a Quaker whaleman could in good conscience agree. Friends not only have a testimony against killing people, but also do not allow games of chance. Charles Ramsdell, the son of a cabinet maker, was a Congregationalist. However, both Owen Coffin and Barzillai Ray were members of Nantucket's Friends Meeting. Although Pollard was not a Quaker, his grandparents had been, and his great-grandmother, Mehitable Pollard, had been a minister. Faced with similarly dire circumstances, other sailors made different decisions. In 1811, the 139-ton brig Polly, on her way from Boston to the Caribbean, was dismasted in a storm, and the crew drifted on the waterlogged hull for 191 days. Although some of the men died from hunger and exposure, their bodies were never used for food. Instead, they were used as bait. Attaching pieces of their dead shipmates' bodies to a trolling line, the survivors managed to catch enough sharks to sustain themselves until their rescue. If the Essex crew had adopted this strategy with the death of Matthew Joy, they might never have reached the extreme that confronted them now. When first presented with young Ramsdell's proposal, Captain Pollard would not listen to it, according to an account related by Nickerson, saying to the others, "No, but if I die first, you are welcome to subsist on my remains." Then Owen Coffin, Pollard's first cousin, the 18-year-old son of his aunt, joined Ramsdell in requesting that they cast lots. Pollard studied his three young companions. Starvation had ringed their sunken eyes with a dark, smudge-like pigmentation. There was little doubt that they were all close to death. It was also clear that all of them, including Barzillai Ray, the orphaned son of a noted island cooper, were in favor of Ramsdell's proposal. As he had two times before, after the knockdown in the Gulf Stream and the sinking of the Essex, Pollard acquiesced to the majority. He agreed to cast lots. If suffering had turned Chase into a compassionate yet forceful leader, Pollard's confidence had been eroded even further by events that reduced him to the most desperate extreme a man can ever know. They cut up a scrap of paper and placed the pieces in a hat. The lot fell to Owen Coffin. "My lad, Pollard cried out. If you don't like your lot, I'll shoot the first man that touches you. Then the captain offered to take the lot himself. Who can doubt but that Pollard would rather have met the death 1,000 times, Nickerson wrote. None that knew him will ever doubt. But Coffin had already resigned himself to his fate. I like it as well as any other, he said softly. Lots were drawn again to see who would shoot the boy. It fell to Coffin's friend, Charles Ramsdell. Even though the lottery had originally been his idea, Ramsdell now refused to follow it through. For a long time, Nickerson wrote, he declared that he could never do it, but finally had to submit. Before he died, Coffin spoke a parting message to his mother, which Pollard promised to deliver if he should make it back to Nantucket. Then Coffin asked for a few moments of silence. After reassuring the others that the lots had been fairly drawn, he lay his head down on the boat's gunwale. He was soon dispatched, Pollard would later recall, and nothing of him left. Chapter 12. In the Eagle's Shadow. Chase and his men lay in the bottom of their boat in a cold drizzle. All they had to shield them from the rain was a piece of tattered, water-soaked canvas. Even had it been dry, Nickerson wrote, it would have been but a poor apology for covering. On January 28, 1821, the breeze finally shifted into the west, but it brought them little comfort. It had nearly become indifferent to us, Chase wrote, from what quarter it blew. They now had too far to go and too few provisions to have any hope of reaching land. Their only chance was to be sighted by a ship. It was this narrow hope alone, Chase remembered, that prevented me from lying down at once to die. They had 14 days of hardtack left, but that assumed they could live 2 more weeks on only 1.5 ounces a day. We were so feeble, Nickerson wrote, that we could scarcely crawl about the boat upon our hands and knees. Chase realized that if he didn't increase their daily portion of bread, they all might be dead in as few as 5 days. It was time to abandon the strict rationing regime that had brought them this far and let the men eat as pinching necessity demanded. Success in a long-term survival situation requires that a person display an active-passive approach to the gradual and agonizing unfolding of events. The key factor is the realization that passivity is itself a deliberate and active act, the survival psychologist John Leach writes. There is strength in passivity. After more than 2 months of regimenting every aspect of his men's lives, Chase intuitively understood this, that it was now time to give ourselves wholly up to the guidance and disposal of our Creator. They would eat as much bread as they needed to stave off death and see where the westerly wind took them. By February 6th, they were still alive, but just barely. Our sufferings were now drawing to a close, the first mate wrote. A terrible death appeared shortly to await us. The slight increase in food intake had brought a return to their hunger pangs, which were now violent and outrageous. They found it difficult to talk and think clearly. Dreams of food and drink continued to torment them. Often did our fevered minds wander to the side of some richly supplied table, Nickerson remembered. His fantasies always ended the same way, with him crying at the disappointment. That night, rain squalls forced them to shorten sail. The off-islander Isaac Cole was on watch, and rather than awaken his companions, he attempted to lower the jib himself. But it proved too much for him. Chase and Nickerson awoke the next morning to find Cole despondent in the bilge of the boat. He declared that all was dark in his mind. Not a single ray of hope was left for him to dwell upon. Like Richard Peterson before him, he had given up, asserting that it was folly and madness to be struggling against what appeared so palpably to be our fixed and settled destiny. Even though he barely had the strength to articulate the words, Chase did his best to change Cole's mind. I remonstrated with him as effectually as the weakness both of my body and understanding would allow of. Suddenly, Cole sat up and crawled to the bow and hoisted the jib he had lowered at such cost the night before. He cried out that he would not give up and that he would live as long as any of them. This effort was, Chase wrote, but the hectic fever of the moment. Cole soon returned to the bottom of the boat, where he lay despairing for the rest of the day and through the night. But Cole would not be permitted the dignity of a quiet and peaceful death. On the morning of February 8th, the 79th day since leaving the Essex, Cole began to rant incoherently, presenting to his frightened crew members a most miserable spectacle of madness. Twitching spasmodically, he sat up and called for a napkin and water, then fell down to the bottom of the boat as if struck dead, only to pop up again like a possessed jack-in-the-box. By 10 o'clock he could no longer speak. Chase and the others placed him on a board they had laid across the seats and covered him with a few pieces of clothing. For the next 6 hours, Cole whimpered and moaned in pain, finally falling into the most horrid and frightful convulsions Chase had ever seen. In addition to dehydration and hypernatremia, an excess amount of salt, he may have been suffering from a lack of magnesium, a mineral deficiency that, when extreme, can cause bizarre and violent behavior. By 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Isaac Cole was dead. It had been 43 days since they'd left Henderson Island, 78 days since they'd last seen the Essex. But no one suggested, at least that afternoon, that they use Cole's body for food. All night the corpse lay beside them, each man keeping his thoughts to himself. When the crew of the Peggy shot and killed a black slave in 1765, one of the men refused to wait for the meat to be cooked. Being ravenously impatient for food, the sailor plunged his hand into the slave's eviscerated body and plucked out the liver and ate it raw. The unhappy man paid dear for such an extravagant impatience, Captain Harrison wrote, for in 3 days after, he died, raving mad. Instead of eating that sailor's body, the crew, being fearful of sharing his fate, threw it overboard. No one dared to consume the flesh of a man who had died insane. The next morning, February 9th, Lawrence and Nickerson began making preparations for burying Cole's remains. Chase stopped them. All night he had wrestled with the question of what they should do. With only 3 days of hardtack left, he knew it was quite possible that they might be reduced to casting lots. Better to eat a dead shipmate, even a tainted shipmate, than be forced to kill a man. "I addressed them," Chase wrote, "on the painful subject of keeping the body for food." Lawrence and Nickerson raised no objections, and fearful that the meat had already begun to spoil, we set to work as fast as we were able. After separating the limbs from the body and removing the heart, they sewed up what remained of Cole's body as decently as they could before they committed it to the sea. Then they began to eat. Even before lighting a fire, the men eagerly devoured the heart, then ate sparingly of a few pieces of the flesh. They cut the rest of the meat into thin strips, some of which they roasted on the fire while the others were laid out to dry in the sun. Chase insisted that he had no language to paint the anguish of our souls in this dreadful dilemma. Making it all the worse was the thought that any one of the remaining three might be next. "We knew not then," the first mate wrote, "to whose lot it would fall next, either to die or be shot, and eaten like the poor wretch we had just dispatched." The next morning they discovered that the strips of flesh had turned a rancid green. They immediately cooked the strips, which provided them with enough meat to last another 6 or 7 days, allowing them to save what little bread they had left for what Chase called the last moment of our trial. In Captain Pollard's boat on February 11th, only 5 days after the execution of Owen Coffin, Barzillai Ray died. Ray, whose biblical first name means made of iron, most firm and true, was 19 years old. It was the 7th death George Pollard and Charles Ramsdell had witnessed in the month and a half since departing Henderson Island. Psychologists studying the phenomenon of battle fatigue during World War II discovered that no soldiers, regardless of how strong their emotional makeup might be, were able to function if their unit experienced losses of 75% or more. Pollard and Ramsdell were suffering from a double burden. Not only had they seen 7 of 9 men die and even killed one of them, but they had been forced to eat their bodies. Like Pip, the black sailor in Moby Dick who loses his mind after several hours of treading water on a boundless sea, Pollard and Ramsdell had been carried down alive to the wondrous depths where strange shapes of the unwarped primal world glided to and fro. Now they were alone, with only the corpse of Barzillai Ray and the bones of Coffin and Reed to sustain them. 3 days later, on February 14th, the 85th day since leaving the wreck, Owen Chase, Benjamin Lawrence, and Thomas Nickerson ate the last of Isaac Cole. A week of living off human flesh, combined with their earlier decision to increase their daily ration of hardtack, had strengthened them to the point where they could once again manage the steering oar. But if they were stronger, they were also in a great deal of pain. As if the boils that covered their skin weren't enough, their arms and legs started to swell shockingly. Known as edema, this disfiguring accumulation of fluid is a common symptom of starvation. Several days of westerly winds had brought them to within 300 miles of the islands of Masafuera and Juan Fernandez. If they averaged 60 miles a day, they might reach safety in another 5 days. Unfortunately, they had only 3 days of hardtack left. "Matters were now with us at their height," Chase wrote. "All hope was cast upon the breeze, and we tremblingly and fearfully awaited its progress and the dreadful development of our destiny. Surrendering all prospects, the men were convinced that after 2.5 months of suffering they were about to die nearly within sight of salvation." That night Owen Chase lay down to sleep, almost indifferent whether I should ever see the light again. He dreamed he saw a ship just a few miles away, and even though he strained every nerve to get to her, she sailed off into the distance, never to return. Chase awoke, almost overpowered with the frenzy I had caught in my slumbers, and stung with the cruelties of a diseased and disappointed imagination. The next afternoon, Chase saw a thick cloud to the northeast, a sure sign of land. It must be the island of Masafuera. At least, that was what Chase told Lawrence and Nickerson. In 2 days, he assured them, they would be on dry land. At first, his companions were reluctant to believe him. Gradually, however, after repeated assurances of the favorable appearance of things on the part of Chase, their spirits acquired even a degree of elasticity that was truly astonishing. The wind remained favorable all night, and with their sails trimmed perfectly and a man tending the steering oar, their little boat made the best time of the voyage. The next morning, the clouds still loomed ahead. The end of their ordeal was apparently only days away. But for 15-year-old Thomas Nickerson, the strain of anticipation had become too much. After bailing out the boat, he lay down, drew the mildewed piece of canvas over him like a shroud, and told his fellow crew members that he wished to die immediately. "I saw that he had given up," Chase wrote, "and I attempted to speak a few words of comfort and encouragement to him. But all the arguments that had served the first mate so well failed to penetrate Nickerson's inner gloom. A fixed look of settled and forsaken despondency came over his face," Chase wrote. "He lay for some time silent, sullen, and sorrowful, and I felt at once that the coldness of death was fast gathering upon him." It was obvious to Chase that some form of dementia had seized the boy. Having watched Isaac Cole slip into a similar madness, Chase could not help but wonder if all of them were about to succumb to the temptations of despair. "There was a sudden and unaccountable earnestness in his manner," he wrote, "that alarmed me and made me fear that I myself might unexpectedly be overtaken by a like weakness, or dizziness of nature, that would bereave me at once of both reason and life." Whether or not it had been communicated to him through Cole's diseased flesh, Chase also felt the stirrings of a death wish as dark and palpable as the pillar-like cloud ahead. At 7 o'clock the next morning, February 18th, Chase was sleeping in the bottom of the boat. Benjamin Lawrence was standing at the steering oar. Throughout the ordeal, the 21-year-old boat steerer had demonstrated remarkable fortitude. He was the one who, 2 months earlier, had volunteered to swim underneath the boat to repair a sprung plank. As Lawrence had watched Peterson, Cole, and now Nickerson lose their grip on life, he had clung as best he could to hope. It was something his careworn family had become good at. His grandfather, George Lawrence, had married Judith Coffin, the daughter of a well-to-do merchant. For many years, the Lawrences had been part of the island's Quaker elite, but by the time Benjamin came into the world, his grandfather had suffered several financial reversals. The proud old man decided to move to Alexandria, Virginia, where, he told an acquaintance, he could descend into a humble sphere among strangers rather than remain in a place where every object reminded him of his lost prosperity. When Benjamin was 10 years old, his father died during a voyage to Alexandria, leaving his wife with 7 children to support. Safe in Lawrence's pocket was the piece of twine he had been working on ever since they'd left the wreck. It was now close to 12 inches long. He leaned into the steering oar and scanned the horizon. "There's a sail!" he cried. Chase immediately scrambled to his feet. Just visible over the horizon was the speck of pale brown that Lawrence had taken for a sail. Chase stared for several suspenseful moments, gradually realizing that, yes, it was a sail, the topgallant of a ship about 7 miles away. "I do not believe it is possible," Chase wrote, "to form a just conception of the pure, strong feelings and the unmingled emotions of joy and gratitude that took possession of my mind on this occasion." Soon even Nickerson was up on his feet and gazing excitedly ahead. Now the question was whether they could catch up to the much larger vessel. The ship was several miles to leeward, which was an advantage for the smaller vessel, and heading slightly north of their position, which meant that it might intercept their line of sail. Could their whaleboat reach that crossing point at approximately the same time the ship did? Chase could only pray that his nightmare of the missed rescue ship would not prove true. "I felt at the moment," Chase wrote, "a violent and unaccountable impulse to fly directly towards her." For the next 3 hours, they were in a desperate race. Their battered old whaleboat skimmed lightly over the waves at between 4 and 6 knots in the northwesterly breeze. Up ahead, the ship's sail plan continued to emerge from the distant horizon, revealing with excruciating slowness not only the topgallant sails, but the topsails beneath, and finally, the mainsail and foresail. Yes, they assured themselves, they were catching up to the ship. There was no lookout at the vessel's masthead, but eventually someone on deck saw them approaching to windward and behind. Chase and his men watched in tense fascination as the ant-like figures bustled about the ship, shortening sail. Gradually, the whaleboat closed the distance, and the hull of the merchantman rose up out of the sea, looming larger and larger ahead of them until Chase could read her quarterboard. She was the Indian from London. Chase heard a shout and through glazed, reddened eyes, saw a figure at the quarterdeck rail with a trumpet, a hailing device resembling a megaphone. It was an officer of the Indian asking who they were. Chase summoned all his strength to make himself heard, but his desiccated tongue stumbled over the words, "Essex, whale ship, Nantucket." The narratives of shipwreck survivors are filled with accounts of captains refusing to take castaways aboard. In some instances, the officers were reluctant to share their already low supply of provisions. In others, they were fearful the survivors might be suffering from communicable diseases. But as soon as Chase explained that they were from a wreck, the Indian's captain immediately insisted that they come alongside. When Chase, Lawrence, and Nickerson attempted to climb aboard, they discovered that they didn't have the strength. The three men stared up at the crew, their eyes wide and huge within the dark hollows of their skulls. Their raw, ulcerated skin hung from their skeletons like noxious rags. As he looked down from the quarterdeck, Captain William Crozier was moved to tears at what Chase called the most deplorable and affecting picture of suffering and misery. The English sailors lifted the men from their boat and carried them to the captain's cabin. Crozier ordered the cook to serve them their first taste of civilized food, tapioca pudding. Made from the root of the cassava plant, tapioca is a high-calorie, easy-to-digest food rich in the proteins and carbohydrates that their bodies craved. Rescue came at latitude 33 degrees 45 minutes south, longitude 81 degrees 3 minutes west. It was the 89th day since Chase and his men had left the Essex, and at noon they came within sight of Massafuera. Chase had succeeded in navigating them across a 2,500-mile stretch of ocean with astonishing accuracy. Even though they had sometimes been so weak that they could not steer their boat, they had somehow managed to sail almost to within sight of their intended destination. In just a few days, the Indian would be in the Chilean port of Valparaiso. Trailing behind on a tow line was the whaleboat that had served the Nantucketers so well. Captain Crozier hoped to sell the old boat in Valparaiso and establish a fund for the men's relief. But the next night the weather blew up to a gale, and the boat, empty of men for the first time in 3 months, was lost. 300 miles to the south, Pollard and Ramsdell sailed on. For the next 5 days, they pushed east until by February 23rd, the 94th day since leaving the wreck, they were approaching the island of St. Mary's just off the Chilean coast. Over a year before, this had been the Essex's first landfall after rounding Cape Horn. Pollard and Ramsdell were on the verge of completing an irregular circle with a diameter of more than 3,000 miles. It had been 12 days since the death of Barzillai Ray. They had long since eaten the last scrap of his flesh. The two famished men now cracked open the bones of their shipmates, beating them against the stone on the bottom of the boat and smashing them with the boat's hatchet, and ate the marrow which contained the fat their bodies so desperately needed. Pollard would later remember these as days of horror and despair. Both of them were so weak that they could barely lift their hands. They were drifting in and out of consciousness. It is not uncommon for castaways who have been many days at sea and suffered both physically and emotionally to lapse into what has been called a sort of collective confabulation, in which the survivors exist in a shared fantasy world. Delusions may include comforting scenes from home, perhaps, in the case of Pollard and Ramsdell, a sunny June day on the Nantucket Commons during the sheep-shearing festival. Survivors may find themselves in conversation with deceased shipmates and family members as they lose all sense of time. For Pollard and Ramsdell, it was the bones, gifts from the men they had known and loved, that became their obsession. They stuffed their pockets with finger bones. They sucked the sweet marrow from the splintered ribs and thighs. And they sailed on, the compass card wavering toward east. Suddenly, they heard a sound. Men shouting, and then silence as shadows fell across them, and then the rustle of wind in sails and the creaking of spars and rigging. They looked up, and there were faces. Of the Dauphin's 21-man crew, at least three, Dymond Peters, Asnan Keats, and Joseph Squibb, were Wampanoags from Cape Cod and Martha's Vineyard. As children, they had been taught a legend about the discovery of Nantucket that told of how, long before the arrival of the Europeans, a huge eagle appeared over a village on Cape Cod. The eagle would swoop down out of the sky and carry off children in its talons, then disappear over the waters to the south. Finally, the villagers asked a benevolent giant named Mowshop to find out where the eagle was taking their children. Mowshop set off to the south, wading through the water until he came to an island he had never seen before. After searching all over the island, he found the bones of the children piled high beneath a large tree. On the morning of February 23rd, the crew of the Dauphin made a similar discovery. Looking down from a restless forest of spars and sails, they saw two men in a whaleboat filled with bones. The men were not much more than skeletons themselves, and the story that would be passed from ship to ship in the months ahead was that they were found sucking the bones of their dead messmates, which they were loath to part with. The Dauphin's captain, Zimri Coffin, ordered his men to lower a boat and bring the two survivors aboard. Like Chase, Lawrence, and Nickerson before them, Pollard and Ramsdell were too weak to stand and had to be lifted up to the whale ship's deck. Both men were, in the words of a witness, very low when first brought aboard, but after being given some food, Pollard made an astonishing recovery. At around 5 o'clock that evening, the Dauphin spoke the whale ship Diana from New York. The Diana's captain, Aaron Paddock, toward the end of a successful voyage, joined Captain Coffin for dinner. Also joining them was Captain George Pollard, Jr., formerly of the Essex. Like many survivors, Pollard was animated by a fierce and desperate compulsion to tell his story. just as the gaunt, wild-eyed ancient mariner of Coleridge's poem poured forth each harrowing detail to the wedding guest, so did Pollard tell them everything. How his ship had been attacked in a most deliberate manner by a large sperm whale, how they had headed south in the whaleboats, how his boat had been attacked once again, this time by an unknown fish, and how they had found an island where a few fowl and fish was the only sustenance. He told them that three men still remained on the island. He told of how the rest of them had set out for Easter Island and how Matthew Joy had been the first to die. He told of how Chase's boat had become separated from them in the night and how, in rapid succession, four black men became food for the remainder. Then he told how, after separating from the second mate's boat, he and his crew were reduced to the deplorable necessity of casting lots. He told of how the lot fell to Owen Coffin, who, with composure and resignation, submitted to his fate. Lastly, he told of the death of Barzillai Ray and how Ray's corpse had kept both him and Ramsdell alive. Later that night, once he had returned to the Diana, Captain Paddock wrote it all down, calling Pollard's account the most distressing narrative that ever came to my knowledge. The question now became one of how the survivors would fare in the dark shadow of their story. Chapter 13. Homecoming. On February 25, 1821, Chase, Lawrence, and Nickerson arrived in Valparaiso, Chile's largest port, set on a steep hill facing north across a wide bay. At any other time, the story of the Essex would have captivated the city, but in February and March of that year, the citizens of Valparaiso were tensely awaiting news from the north. Revolutionary forces, having already secured Chile's independence from Spain, were bearing down on royalists in Lima. It was Peru, not a few American castaways, that demanded Valparaiso's attention, allowing the Essex survivors to recuperate in relative privacy. From the beginning, Chase and his men spoke openly about having resorted to cannibalism. On the day of the Nantucketers' arrival, the keeper of the port's official log of incoming and outgoing vessels matter-of-factly reported that the captain of the Indian had picked up three men who survived with a little water and crackers, and with a shipmate that died and that they ate in the term of 8 days. The U.S. frigate Constellation was anchored at Valparaiso, and the acting American consul, Henry Hill, arranged to have Chase, Lawrence, and Nickerson taken to it. Even though it had been a week since their rescue, the survivors still presented an affecting sight. Their appearance was truly distressing, wrote Commodore Charles Goodwin Ridgely, commander of the Constellation. Bones working through their skins, their legs and feet much smaller, and the whole surface of their bodies one entire ulcer. Ridgely placed the three men under the care of his surgeon, Dr. Leonard Osborne, who supervised their recovery in the frigate's sickbay deep in the forward part of the third deck. It may have been hot and airless, but for three men who had spent 89 consecutive days beneath the open sky, it was a wonderful comfort. The crew of the Constellation was so profoundly moved by the sufferings of Chase and his men that each sailor donated $1 toward their assistance. When this was combined with money collected from the American and British residents of Valparaiso, the Essex survivors had more than $500 to help defray the costs of their convalescence. But the men's sufferings were not yet over. As the participants in the Minnesota starvation experiment discovered in 1945, the recovery period was a torturous part of the ordeal. After 3 months, the Minnesota volunteers still had not returned to their normal weights, even though some were consuming more than 5,000 calories a day. They would eat until their stomachs could not take any more, yet they still felt hungry. Many would continue to eat between meals. It wasn't until after 6 months of supernormal eating that they had regained the bodies they had once possessed. The Essex survivors were in much worse shape than the volunteers in the Minnesota experiment. After 3 months of abuse, their digestive systems had a difficult time handling the intake of increased quantities of food, a problem shared by Captain David Harrison of the Peggy in 1765. Upon his rescue, Harrison was given some chicken broth. It had been 37 days since he'd last had a bowel movement, and soon after drinking some of the broth, he was racked by excruciating abdominal pain. "I was, at last, relieved," Harrison wrote, "by the discharge of a callous lump about the size of a hen's egg, and enjoyed a tranquillity of body, notwithstanding all my disorders, with which I was utterly unacquainted for some preceding weeks." The day after their arrival in Valparaiso, Chase and his men received a visit from the governor, who had heard rumors that, instead of being the survivors of a wreck, the first mate and his men had killed the Essex's captain in a bloody mutiny. "For there was a whispering abroad," Nickerson wrote, "that foul play had been used by us." The governor was reassured enough by Chase's story that he allowed the Nantucketers to go freely about the city as soon as they were able. A week and a half later, on March 9th, the Nantucket whale ship Hero arrived in Valparaiso. While cutting in a whale off St. Mary's Island, she'd been attacked by Spanish pirates. The Spaniards imprisoned the captain and the cabin boy on shore, then locked the rest of the crew below decks and began to ransack the ship. When an unknown vessel appeared in the harbor, the pirates returned briefly to shore, allowing First Mate Obed Starbuck to burst open the cabin door and retake the ship. Starbuck ordered his men to set sail, and although the pirates came to within yards of catching up to the fleeing whale ship, the Nantucketers were able to reach safety. As dramatic as that report was, the Hero bore even more sensational news. With Mate Starbuck acting as skipper, the Hero had encountered three whale ships sailing together as an informal group: the Dauphin, the Diana, and the Two Brothers. Captain Zimri Coffin of the Dauphin told Starbuck that he had the captain of the Essex and another crew member aboard. Shortly afterward, Pollard and Ramsdell were transferred to the Two Brothers, which was headed for Valparaiso. It arrived on March 17th. The five survivors had last seen one another on the night of January 12th, when their boats had become separated in a howling gale more than 2,000 miles out to sea. Since then, two of Chase's crew had died, four of Pollard's, and three of Joy's, then under Hendrick's leadership, before the second mate's boat and the three remaining men disappeared. Only Nantucketers had emerged from Pollard's and Chase's whaleboats alive. They had all suffered terribly, but it was Pollard and Ramsdell, found clutching the bones of their dead companions, who had come the closest to complete psychic disintegration. Of the anguish each of these two experienced, Pollard's was perhaps the greater. A year and a half earlier, his aunt had entrusted him with the care and protection of her oldest son, Owen. Pollard had not only presided over his cousin's execution, but had eaten his flesh, thus participating in what one historian of cannibalism at sea has called the taboo of gastronomic incest. Pollard had demonstrated remarkable stamina immediately after his rescue, but his urgent need to tell his tale had almost killed him. Soon after that first night, he suffered a relapse. When Captain William Coffin of the Nantucket whale ship Eagle offered the Essex survivors passage home, Pollard was judged to be too weak for a voyage around Cape Horn. On March 23rd, Chase, Lawrence, Nickerson, and Ramsdell bid farewell to their captain and left for Nantucket. In May, after 2 months of recuperation and solitary reflection, Pollard followed them in the whale ship Two Brothers. In the meantime, Commodore Ridgely, commander of the Constellation, had made arrangements for the rescue of Chapel, Weeks, and Wright from, as he was told, Ducie Island. Recently arrived in Valparaiso was the Surrey, a trading vessel from Australia being loaded with 15,000 bushels of wheat. Her captain, Thomas Rain, agreed to stop at Ducie on his way back to Sydney and pick up the three Essex crew members, assuming, of course, they were still alive. The Surrey left South America on March 10th. Captain Rain and his crew arrived at Ducie Island less than a month later, only to find the tiny coral atoll uninhabited. The shore was so thick with nesting birds it was impossible to walk without stepping on eggs. Rain decided that no one had visited this necklace of coral in a very long time. He studied his navigational guide and wondered if the Essex officers might have mistaken an island 70 miles to the west for Ducie. A few days later, on April 9th, Henderson Island came within view. They approached it from the east, then began to follow the coastline to the north. Upon rounding a rocky headland, they found a spacious bay to the west. Rain ordered one of his men to fire a gun. At that moment, Chapel, Weeks, and Wright had just sat down to eat a tropic bird. Except for some berries and shellfish, birds and eggs were the only food left on Henderson. The land crabs had disappeared. A few months before, the men had succeeded in catching 5 green turtles, but by the time they had eaten just one of the turtles, the meat on the other 4 had spoiled. Over the last 4 months, the tropic birds had proved exceptionally difficult to find, so the bird they had now was, for them, a bountiful feast. But food was not their gravest concern. What they still needed most was water. From the day after their 17 shipmates left for Easter Island, the spring of fresh water never again emerged above the tide line. At low tide, they could see fresh water bubbling up to the ocean surface from the rock, but for the rest of their time on Henderson, the spring always remained covered by salt water. In desperation, Chapel, Weeks, and Wright dug a series of wells but were unable to reach groundwater. When it rained, they would greedily collect the water that accumulated in the hollows of nearby rocks. Dehydration caused their tongues to swell and their lips to crack. After a 5-day stretch without water, they reluctantly sucked the blood of a tropic bird but found themselves much disordered by it. While searching the crevices and caves for water, they discovered the remains of the 8 unidentified castaways, whose fate they feared would soon be their own. The skeletons lay side by side as if the people had decided to lie down and quietly die together. For Chapel, who had once been the wildest and least responsible of the Essex's crew, it was a sight that helped change his life. From that day forward, he would look to God. "I found religion not only useful," he later wrote, "but absolutely necessary to enable me to bear up under these severe trials." When Chapel, Weeks, and Wright, crouched around their tropic bird feast, heard a distant booming, they assumed it was thunder. But one of the men decided to walk down to the beach and have a look. Later he would tell what had happened as soon as he saw the ship. "The poor fellow," one of the Surrey's crew members reported, "was so overpowered with the emotions such a sight excited in his breast, he could not go to tell his companions the joyful news." Finally, however, they too grew curious and joined him at the beach. A high surf was breaking on the ledge of coral surrounding the island. Several times the crew of the Surrey attempted to land a boat, but the condition